This podcast is offered by Wildflowers and Sangha. A Dharma talk by Joa, celui que sauve, c'est bon.
Yes, good evening, everyone. I feel it's always a challenge to give a talk. There's always a part of my mind that really want to offer something and prepare something that the thing is dense and meaningful, and another part of me feel that I should really manifest what we're practicing, which is being really present with the moment and so finding the right balance between these two things. So among the thoughts that I've kept dwelling in over the past few days that I would like to share with you, one has to do with the second vow that we sing. I always go back to the vows, and I always go back to the precepts and the kind of the fundamentals of our practice that I find are very inspiring for me. And I keep going back to these various elements that we have at hand and try to unpack that. And so I feel that the thoughts that, the things that have been kind of dwelling in over the past few days has a lot to do with the second vow. Reality is boundless. I vow to see it. Or another translation that we had before was, the dharmas are boundless, and I vow to see it. And again, as I remind, I tell that often, that it's always interesting to remember that the dharmas are at the same time, in a very narrow sense, the teachings, and at the same time, all phenomena. So, in short, reality. And one thing that I've been thinking about is, as I'm reading a lot of sutras and a lot of texts, I've been doing that for a couple of years now, I'm astounded by the numbers of stories that we have. I mean, even sometimes stories about the fact that people don't want to tell stories, like the koan that Roshi talks about a lot, the teacher that goes up to the roast room, the altar, and just goes down, or the story about the monk that asks the teacher, a teacher that asks a monk, what does your teacher taught you? And the guy was raised his hand. And in the early Buddhist texts, there are many, many stories. And in as in any spiritual religions, also, that people are trying to draw from their own environments and to tell stories that are actually meaningful. And that's what we do as human beings. We tell stories. And I was listening to, this week, Barack Obama was invited in the French, to speak at the French radio station. And he talked a lot about the power of words, the power of stories, and what kind of stories we're sharing with one another. And it was very interesting to see how he was reflecting on that. He was trying to share things. And what was at the core of the sharing of the stories. And so one one aspect of the story sometimes is they in early texts, for example, they take similes, stories, from which we can draw a teaching from. And I thought, I wanted to share that with you because I thought for me it was so meaningful. I mentioned that last week there was a, and I wanted to draw on that and see where it leads us. There was a sailing race that is finishing right now and called the Vendée Globe. So it started in Vendée, which is southern Brittany, and they go all around the globe and they come back. So for the fastest, it takes about 80 days. For the slowest, it takes much longer. And it's a solitary race without assistance. So it's pretty intense as a race. And one particular feature is that it includes both men and women. They don't have separate categories. It's just one single category. They all have the same type of boats, but very different boats sometimes. Some more older than others. And men, women. And they all have various objectives, various projects. Some of them are there to win the race or expect they make a podium. Some others don't know that they're not going to win because they don't have a fast enough boat, but they just they're just there for the race, for the experience, for the adventure, to participate, but not without the prospect of winning, clearly. Or the question is, for them, winning is not being on the podium. So a long adventure, a long journey, a solitary journey. That is very much like what the Buddha started when he left his home. A long solitary journey, not knowing what he's going to expect, what he's going to experience, what he's going to encounter. And so they were on their boats, and it's very rough. The conditions, especially this edition, were extremely rough, with storms, and there were like some striking expressions. Some of them said that they lived like, in some parts of the race, they really lived like animals. One guy said that he lived like a wild boar, because he was on his knee all the time because the boat was moving so much. You couldn't really eat properly, you can't sleep, it's because it's too noisy. And what they do a lot is that they listen. They listen to the boat. They really, really listen. They know by just the sound of the boat if something is wrong or not. And I've had that experience, I sell myself. There's someone here that I sailed with. He was my sailor buddy, and when you really, especially I mean them with sailing on these boats, they really need to listen. And that reminds me of one of the things that I've read recently, in one of the sutra, that really said that the hearing was most important sense. That was the listening part was the most important of all our six senses, the listening. Starting with the listening. And this is what we do in meditation. We listen. We pay attention. We listen. We listen with our whole body. And the conditions were extremely rough on this edition, and there was one guy that his boat broke open, and so he was rescued. So a lot of them were kind of started to freak out because they thought it could happen to them also. And there was one young woman, she's 31. It was her first race like this. First kind of time she was on this type of boat. I mean, she had prepared herself, but it was the first time that she was doing a race with that boat. And she said that was very striking. She said, I had the feeling that I had a sword of Damocles upon my head, and thinking, what's going to happen next? And then she said, and then at some point I let go of that. I let go of that idea that what's going to happen next. And while she was still dwelling with that thought of what's going to happen next, she was afraid, she felt anguish. And then when she dropped it, she felt released. I don't know if you can relate to that, but I can. That sense of just responding to the situation instead of thinking what's going to happen next to me. God, what's going to be the next bad thing that's going to happen to me? Just, well, when that happens, you just respond. But that makes a huge difference in the experience. I actually have that impression very, very often. I've had that this week, that sometimes my existence is just a succession of just like waves of shit to handle. Taxes and things to do and work and obligations and things to, it's just endless, and you feel, oh God, it's never going to stop. I wish it could stop. And what's going to be the next thing? Now I'm done with that. And it's, and when I'm in that state, it's just exhausting. And I feel the burden of the existence. I feel the burden of daily life. If I stop that thought process, then it's suddenly there are less clouds in my mind. It feels less, crowded. The fascinating thing about this race also, it's a very long race. It's very different from crossing the Atlantic. That takes about a week, 10 days for them. And it's very, they are in one mode. When it lasts 3 months, they have the time to process what they're doing. They have to go, they go through phases. I think if we reflect on our journey in the practice, we've been through many, many, many different phases, haven't we? Very different, very great diversity of moments and it feels very different. Sometimes it feels great, sometimes it feels, we feel like a failure. We feel discouraged. I've met some people who came for their first retreats and they were so excited. They came out with a blissful smile and thinking, yes, that's it. I got it. Yeah, it's great. It's awesome. Love it. I'll come back. And then we never see them again. Some come back. I can't remember my first retreat, but I certainly remember retreats where I've been desperate, where I felt totally bored, where I felt, especially in summertime, when you're middle of the summer and you're doing a week-long retreat in Normandy and it's raining all day and you're going to go back to work the following week, you wonder, what the hell am I doing here? But transformation is a long process. It's a very long process. It's like painting, very fine painting, with small dots or something. I've read a quote from Winston Churchill, that was cited at the end of the movie, The Darkest Hour. And I really liked it. He said, success is not final. Failure is not total. It is the courage to continue that counts. It's the courage to continue that counts. And it needs a lot of courage to continue on that path, frankly. But fortunately, I feel that the community is a kind of a support system. The teacher is a support system. The precepts, all the things that we chant, all the stories can be a source of inspiration that gives us the courage to continue because it inspires us. And what struck me with what the sailors had to say also at the end, they all talked about the experience of solitude. Most of them talked about the experience of solitude, and after a while, they were glad to come back. They were glad to meet again with their families and friends, not just because the race was hard, but more than that, some of them expressed also the realization that, yeah, solitude is all good, but it's all about also being with others. And that, for me, had a lot of echoes to my own experience of solitude. As you know, I've almost had like a year-long experience of solitude over the past year. It was very important for me to deal with the passing away of my mother. But also there was, and out of that also grew the desire, the sense of community, sense of desire to strengthen the relationships. Yeah. It struck me. I was reading this week a very classical Buddhist text that is part of our tradition, Zen tradition, from Ajvagosha, who is a poet, Buddhist poet from the second century, and he. He exposes the various principles of meditation and makes a distinction between shamatha and vipassana, and clear observation. And these two practices, and basically he says that from that practice, how can I say? Emerge the desire to help, the desire to help all sentient beings. And it was partly because he was partly referring also to the Theravada tradition, the Hinayana tradition, where supposedly it's just you practice only for yourself. But more than that, I can see that for myself. It's just like maybe you start from yourself. You start because you want to feel better. You start because you want to reduce stress. You start because all kinds of reasons, like personal reasons. But something out of that grows, out of that expands and starts to include the other one. And I found very inspiring also that these sailors, they have sponsors, and a lot of them wanted to have a sponsor that has a project that has a meaning for others, like, you know, saving children, or for heart surgery towards children, or some ecological projects, various projects, and there was several sailors said, because it's not just about me. It's not just about me going around the globe and doing my little experiment, my personal experiment. It has to serve something else. And it's like, it's a nice way to open up for them to defend the color of some cause or something. So I said one guy, he's Kevin Escoffier, his boat broke down and he ended up in the sea. So he was rescued by someone. And again, there was absolutely no question. Saving all sentient beings. This is what you do. This is the first vow we sing. It was an unconditional help. There wasn't even a single question about whether or not they should go, or whether or not they should feel pissed off because suddenly they lose their position in the race. There was no question about that. And they had some, at the end, the people that helped saving this guy got some extra time. And so at the end, the first guy who crossed the line first was not the guy who actually won the race because of that. So who is the winner? Who was the winner of that race? And some people that arrived 10th, 11th, 12th, they felt they won it because they actually achieved something great for themselves. There was one guy who came, who joined the race in order to win the race, to be on the podium. And he had to, after 10 days, he had to come back because he had problems with his boat and then left again. So he was really mad. He was really pissed. He was really angry about the whole situation. And it was very interesting to actually see him evolving over the course of the race, because he realized, yeah, it's something else now. And he experienced something very different. And at some point he said, oh, it's funny, at some point I spoke with the other guys around me, which is not something I usually do in a race because I'm there to win and I don't have time to speak with other people. So I actually got to know the other sailors. It was actually a wonderful experience, and I will think about it next time. Something got totally transformed for him through that. So yeah, there was a lot of teachings in that, in all that for me, in the hearing all these stories, and it made a lot of sense. A lot of things that I could relate to in that experience. So reality is boundless, I vow to see it. Like, can we draw from all the experiences, all the stories that we hear, all our encounters, can we draw some meaningful teachings that helps us grow? And going back to Barack Obama, it was so inspiring to hear that the backbone of all his stories was about inclusiveness, was about sharing, was about being together. And I, while listening to him, I thought, what could the other president that just left the office could think if he could hear these words? Because it was the exact opposite of that. It was just for him. It was not inclusive. It was not making us grow as human beings. It wasn't making us flourish. Yeah, and I went back to this young author, this young poet that was there at the inauguration, and I just love the last lines of her poem. And she says, when day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as free as we free it. For there is always light, if only we are brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it. If only we're brave enough to be it. She pondered a lot about, apparently, with this be it. She tried many things and then she settled for be it. And this is really our last vow also, to embody the way. The Buddha way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it, if we're brave enough to be it. I think I will stop there and open up to remarks, questions, reflections, thoughts. Anyone who would like to start, you can raise your hand or using the little hand thing.
Francis has wisely chosen his background, as if he knew the theme before. So will you sometime participate in that race?
No, I don't think I would be capable. But the interesting thing is that the oldest sailor was, I don't know, 61, I think, something like that. So again, it was like men, women, young, old, older. They were all competing in the same category. And there was even someone who actually was part of the Paralympic as a sailor. So he had one hand, only one hand. So that was a big, and he finished fourth, I think. So that was a great accomplishment for him and for everyone, because it really showed that there was no limit. Yes, Barbara?
Yeah, hi, I'm Barbara. I'm a friend of Deb's. This is the first time I've ever come. And I just wanted to tell you, it was wonderful to hear you, Joa. I meditate, but I have very little knowledge of the Sumatras and the stories. But I related so much to what you shared. I loved what you said about the, you know, of all the senses, listening is the most important. And I mean, it was interesting because everything you talked about, I just listened to the interview with Barack Obama today that was on France Inter. And it was just so moving to listen to such a great man, his humility, and just the idea that, you know, he said, I've been privileged. And, you know, that like now his responsibility, if you like, is to help other people. And of course, he talked about Amanda Gorman and that wonderful poem. So I was thinking, well, I might not understand anything in the Dharma talk tonight or anything that's shared because I'm not knowledgeable about all the teachings. But in fact, you just related everything so clearly and so simply. So I just really want to thank you for that. It was wonderful to listen to. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I think I'm always, it's a big challenge because I feel at the same time, it is so simple. And at the same time, it is so subtle. And yeah, one thing that I haven't said also about this race, and that also relates to our practice, is they go around the globe, so they come back where they started. They haven't gone anywhere. They come back where they have started. And yet, they have done a hell of a journey. Solitude, going, living like wild boars, the sound, and just everything. All of them had to do repairs, and very complicated repairs, very scary repairs, going on top of their, it's horrendous what they had to do. And when I think of the stories of Shakyamuni and what is being said in the text and all his ascetic practices and even the start, leaving home, I mean, leaving his wife. We're not quite sure about leaving his kids because there's all kinds of stories around it, but he left home. What a sacrifice is that? I mean, none of us were requested to leave their homes in that form, but we leave something. And I think what we leave, what we break with are a former habitual way to live. We leave ourselves, our ideas about who we are. We step in a completely uncharted territory. To go where, really? To really come back to this, to that moment, to... But what a journey. And it's such a help to be together in that and to help each other in that and to support each other. And I can't emphasize more how, you know, the value of all these moments of doubts and where we feel we're never going to make it. I think all these sailors at some point, or some of the sailors really had these moments of doubts and fear and just like, never going to make it. I'm never going to arrive back at Les Sables d'Olonne. In that movie, The Dark Hour, that I mentioned about Winston Churchill, at some point I wrote down that his wife, at some point, he has big decisions to make, and his wife says, "These inner battles have trained you for this very moment. You are strong because you are imperfect. You are wise because you have doubts." And in Buddhist literature, there are always this representation of these dark forces, Mara the tempter, that can take many forms, our doubts, our addictions, our cravings, and that takes many forms. And that's part of it. That's part of reality. And can we see that? Can we really see it and say, "This is me," and face it? Yeah, Barbara.
Hello, everybody. Sometimes in this journey, I think it's very difficult to appreciate the ordinary as extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Okay? Indeed, it's very difficult. Look in your life, the common, the ordinary things, how extraordinary is. Deep listen, it's very difficult. Pay attention, as Amy usually says. It's very difficult in our journey. Yes. I listen
and as your Dharma, and I ask myself what is difficult in my journey this week, and deepen listen, pay attention, common things, the ordinary things, how wonderful, how extraordinary these things are. Yes. Yes, Joa, it's questions in our journey, in our practice. Very hard and beautiful and extraordinary. Thank you for your Dharma.
Yeah, the reality doesn't change. What is being transformed is how we experience it. And that comes, I mean, it grows into a sense of deep appreciation, I feel, when we really see it, when we really, this thing about Ashvaghosha that I find really beautiful, like it's really, if you really listen deeply within yourself and you really see things, see reality, see the other, then you really see that it's just like me. And if it's just like me, it's just like you want to reach out. And so this saving all sentient beings is really the, it comes first, it's born out of our ability to witness, to bear witness, as Bernie Glassman would have said, bearing witness. We bear witness and we respond to it, and that includes, that ends up including the other one. It's not even including, it's like you really just, yeah, you're one. You see it. But it's, we can hear a lot of stories about it. We can talk about it. We can philosophize about it. But it's really just, these stories are not only, I mean, it's a way to, I feel it's a way to testify about it. And it's also a way to inspire us also. When I started my practice, I had meditation groups at my place. I was a teenager, and we had teachers coming over every week. And I was very interested with the meditation, but not really interested in the teachings. And my rationale about it was that, well, either I have the experience, and then why listening to a talk? Or if I don't have the experience, then why listening to a talk? Because I won't understand it. And they're going to talk about something that I haven't experienced, and therefore I will probably not even understand. And I look at it now, I mean, this is where I was at the time, but I feel sometimes a Dharma talk that I listened to was just went over my head. And sometimes you click with something and it inspires you and you grab. I remember I remember something that Roshi said 20 years ago. she finished the talk saying, clinging to Amy is where the suffering is. I remember that. And I was like, wow, that helped. All right, it's time. So maybe we'll close there and we'll... did Juan disappear? Where is he? Oh, Juan, you're here. Yeah. So we'll finish with the vows. Well, thank you so much for listening and sharing.